John of Damascus is such an important figure, sometimes seen as shared by both the Eastern branch of Christianity and the Western branch of Christianity. And the 8th century is a time where we really do need to be tracing these different storylines and the complexities of them.
Does doctrine really matter? The Apostle Paul once wrote to a young pastor named Titus, instructing him to hold firm to the trustworthy word he was taught, so that he may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine. Welcome to Credo Podcast, where doctrine matters and theological ideas have consequences. Here's your host, Dr. Matthew Barrett, executive editor of Credo Magazine and associate professor of Christian theology at Midwestern Seminary.
Welcome to the Credo Podcast, where we model faith-seeking understanding as together we gaze at the beauty of the Lord with the great tradition. Now, I almost never do this, but if I had to pick, if you've really forced me to pick one or two theologians that I really could spend the rest of my life with, I'm very very confident that John of Damascus would have to be in that list. As much as I love Calvin, or you've heard me talk about Anselm or Athanasius, or in our last episode, we talked about Irenaeus and his book Against Heresies. Nonetheless, still, John of Damascus would really rise to the top for me. And the reason I say that, well, I'm quite biased, aren't I? Because I'm a theologian myself, and I find myself so resonating with his life as well as his writings. And there, I don't just mean the import of them, but the way that they shaped the church for centuries to come. I think John of Damascus, for me at least, is so important because he both looks inward and outward. On the one hand, he's trying to give an answer to the real challenge and sometimes real threat of Islamic rule that is approaching. And yet at the same time, he is also giving Christians a whole theology. I can't tell you how many times I have returned to his work, The Fount of Wisdom, and his section on the Orthodox faith, where he is contemplating everything from the Trinity to the incarnation to the mystery of participation in the beatific vision. But what many may not know is that his life and the church at the time was not just filled with turmoil because of, say, Islam, but also this is a divisive period in the history of the church. Just to take one example, Christians are debating each other over whether they should or should not use icons during worship. Well, it's hard to think of anyone better to talk about such a difficult and complex issue as this than Jennifer Powell McNutt, who is a professor of theology and the history of Christianity at Wheaton College, as well as David McNutt, who is Senior Acquisitions Editor at Zondervan Academic. Jennifer, David, thanks so much for coming back. We talked about Irenaeus and Against Heresies. Thanks for coming back yet again, this time to talk about John of Damascus, out of all people.
Thanks so much for having us back. We loved the last one.
Well, in our last episode, we really entered into the complexity of, say, the church in the midst of persecution, and you know why there's this appeal to what you call the family of God, given what Paul says in Ephesians 1. But as we move forward in time, we meet John of Damascus, and we meet him at a very difficult point in time, right? Islam is on the move. And I mean, if you are a Christian at this time, let's just be honest. This is a precarious moment. You may not be sure whether Christianity will survive. In fact, you may not even be sure if you will live to continue to worship in the church. This created, to say the least, this created no little anxiety for Christians. It also put them up, to use a boxing metaphor here, it put them up against the ropes, and they started to look around, who's going to defend the Christian faith for us as we are seeing right in front of our eyes Islam and its conquest of, say, Constantinople. Can you, David and Jennifer, can you help us understand? I mean, this is in some ways so foreign to us, right? But in other ways, this continues to be the history of the church and the world that we still know to this day.
That's right. Yeah. John of Damascus is such an important figure, sometimes seen as shared by both the Eastern branch of Christianity and the Western branch of Christianity. And the 8th century is a time where we really do need to be tracing these different storylines and the complexities of them. You can already see, for example, the, Syrian missions of the Church of the East moving into Asia, moving into China, the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Eastern Empire, the Byzantine Empire, is grappling with the rise of Islam in the seventh century and its rapid takeover of land, eventually culminating in the fall of Constantinople in 1453. And at that point, according to Philip Jenkins, as we move into the 15th and 16th century, 90% of Christians are living in Europe. And then, of course, in the West, at the same time, you have had recovery from the fall of the Roman Empire since the 5th century, and the consolidation and emergence surrounding Charlemagne's leadership in 800, and really a flourishing that's going to take place in the West. And so certain questions that are troubling theologically will not necessarily, for certain parts of the church, are not necessarily shared by all the branches of the church. And so when we look to John of Damascus, especially, we want to understand his place as a second generation in his family, as one who is having to navigate and discern what it means to be a Christian in this context, and especially with a faith, with the Islamic faith and its sort of iconoclastic views and concerns over idolatry. These are just questions that the West won't have to discuss or really think about until the 16th century. So, but of course will eventually. So it is a special and very helpful, I think, time as he is affirming things like the doctrine of the incarnation and what that can mean.
Yeah, he's such an interesting figure that you're right. It's both a very foreign context for us and at the same time resonates still with a lot of our experiences. So the broader question really for John was, what does it mean to be faithful under my particular circumstances? And that in a way is the sort of, I think, foreign element to us with, as Jennifer was saying, the rise of Islam. John finds himself in Damascus, which had been a center of Christianity for centuries. Think about Paul on the road to Damascus, going to search out Christians, that's where they were known to be. So John finds himself in this, historic center of Christianity, but at the time it was under Islamic rule. He's serving in a Muslim court. And so until eventually he finds that he has to leave the court. And so he flees and goes to a monastery outside Jerusalem where he spends the rest of his life writing things like Fountain Wisdom and other things. And so he's this really interesting figure, theologically, kind of between East and West. He's a kind of pivotal figure in between the patristic era and the medieval period. Some people describe him as the last of the church fathers or the first of the medieval theologians. So, throughout his theology, you see his engagement with the tradition of the church. You see his engagement with scripture, all in ways that are expressive of his faith for his particular context and time.
Now, we've mentioned Islam, but we've also mentioned icons. Paint a picture for us. Our listeners, if you're listening, you may come from any number of backgrounds. Some of you may be from a church background where icons are, they're nowhere in sight. In fact, even just raising the mention of them is strange and a foreign land to you. For others who are listening, icons may be something that, well, they're there every church Sunday in which you encounter them. And the visual, even the visual experience of a Sunday morning, you couldn't conceive of church apart from them. Now, talk to us then about David, Jennifer. Given you know these different backgrounds, we come into this this 8th century era in which suddenly the mention of these icons, it's dividing Christians, and both sides are quite passionate, to maybe just put it mildly, to the point where we have, you know, to use the labels of history, we have these iconoclasts on the one hand who are quite opposed. But on the other hand, we have iconophiles, as we might call them, that believe there is justification for icons, especially given the incarnation of the Son of God himself. It's a complex period, isn't it? There's politics and there's exiles, and what exactly is happening?
Yeah, it's such a fascinating story, and one that I think, you know, in the West, we're not as familiar with this story, but in the East, it has really shaped the Orthodox Church. Yeah. And John finds himself right in the middle of this controversy. I'll paint with a big paintbrush and a broad canvas for a moment, just to point out that, of course, as we live out our faith, our orthodoxy, our right thinking, our right belief is related to our orthopraxy, right? Our living out of the faith, the practice of the faith. And central to our practice of the faith is our worship. So we know, of course, that Christians worship in different styles and in different ways. And some traditions, Eastern Orthodox still to this day, Roman Catholicism, certain elements of the Protestant Church are not just comfortable with, but embrace the use of images or icons, not from their perspective because they're worshiping those things themselves, but rather that they worship God through those things. They see them as aids to their worship of God. Whereas, of course, other Christians, such, you know, different elements of the Protestant tradition have pushed back pretty strongly on that. So I think it's just more broadly speaking, helpful reminder that just as Christians have expressed their faith differently over the centuries, we have often expressed our worship of God differently. And so for the Eastern Orthodox tradition, the icons were all already being used in worship. And so what happens in the 8th and 9th centuries with the iconoclast controversies was, well, what if that is taken away? What happens? And this is precisely what happened under Leo III, that for one reason or another in the early 8th century, and to your point, it is complex. Like, there are political motivations and questions, as there often are in the history of the church. You know, was it a theological issue? You know, that was the basis for his removal of those, his, you know, prohibiting those. Was it because an icon cannot, you know, depict Christ as fully human and fully divine, according to some? Was it because of the iconoclasm of Islam and Judaism that was preventing missions? And, you know, so there's all kinds of questions floating around that. And John found himself right in the middle of it and appealed to exactly what you mentioned, the incarnation, to say, you know, yes, we need to be concerned about idolatry. And John is very clear that, you know, we are not capable of depicting the triune God, you know, the living God in God's fullness. But everything changed. The game completely changed when God took on flesh in Christ. Because now, for this one who is still fully God, but fully human, now he can be depicted, according to John and other iconophiles, as you term them, that's right, iconoduals, sometimes they're called. Now we can do that. And actually, these can be aids for us in the context of worship.
Yeah, I think it's important to keep in mind that the earliest Arabic Christians, we don't usually think about that category, but Christians living under Islamic rule are considered part of the Arabic Christian tradition, that they are navigating accusations of polytheism in a monotheistic culture, and having to really explain what does it mean that Jesus is the Son of God, and how do we understand the Trinity, and how are we not committing idolatry by depicting Jesus? And John of Damascus offers a really important distinction between two categories. One is the worship that is owed only to God, which is known as latria, and worship that is in veneration, so it's kind of a respect. It is an honoring, and that is called dulia. And that distinction will become important to the Roman Catholic Church again in the 16th century when iconoclasm emerges, and some of our Protestant traditions will find that explanation is not helpful enough or not suitable enough. Nonetheless, it will serve as an explanation for many centuries.
Hi, friends. This is Matthew Barrett. I'm interrupting this conversation to tell you about something quite exciting. Each November, we have a special meeting hosted by the Center for Classical Theology. This is an arm of Credo, and it's an opportunity to come together once a year in order to hear a lecture from a well-known theologian in order to renew and restore classical theology today. This November, Michael Horton will be giving this lecture, and he will be addressing us in San Diego, California, talking to us about what it means to affirm sola scriptura as it was originally intended, and how we do that in light of Catholicity. I look forward to hearing what he has to say, followed by a panel of other theologians discussing it as well. I hope you will join me in San Diego this November. Now, Jennifer, I can't resist here, because I also happen to know that you have a love and expertise in the Reformation itself. this, like you hinted at, it comes up again, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I can't help but mention the Reformation.
yeah. No, that you're one of a kind with me here. I'm tracking with you. if we tease this out just a little bit further, when we come to the Reformation, on the one hand, you have, over in, let's just take Zwingli, for example, and the Swiss, you have a very strong reaction against any type of visible representation. And this results sometimes even in riots as they're smashing and burning statues or images and just about everything. And then yet at the same time, or around the same time, you have other reformers in other, pockets or corners of the Reformation, sometimes in Germany, sometimes over in Geneva, in which they too are quite concerned about, say, how different images or icons have been used or maybe misused in what we would call the Roman Catholic Church. And yet they're also not quite as quick to smash or burn everything. You think of that, it's a fascinating story where in Geneva, yes, they remove a number of them, but Calvin still keeps some in the attic. and then you have Luther and Melanchthon over in Germany and in Wittenberg, and it depends on the day of the week sometimes with Luther, but sometimes he's quite adamant against, and then other times he has a certain appreciation for the visual. This has led to all kinds of fascinating discussion, because, you think of some of the books that have been written even recently talking about, well, Calvin believed in icons, but they were the icons of creation itself. And then, he develops this whole theology of creation and how we're in the image of God, et cetera. All that to say, the discussion doesn't, or debate doesn't necessarily go away with the Reformation, but it does seem to evolve in almost with a Protestant flavor. Do you have any insight here? Because the reason I mention this is, I know this is a long way of getting at this point, but the reason I mention this is because some of our listeners might think, okay, we shouldn't have any category whatsoever for that which visually depicts the things of Christianity. But even some of the reformers themselves are wrestling with these questions. Well, what exactly does that mean? To what extreme or not? Jennifer, do you have any insight here?
Yeah. I mean, I think, first of all, we should start with the fact that in John of Damascus's time and context, he is seeking to affirm the incarnation of Jesus. And that does have a particularity in that place and in conversation with Islam, because that does get at the heart of the matter. And then having to explain, why is this still a monotheistic faith, but with an affirmation of three persons in one essence? So that's what they're dealing with. This is where we, when we get to the 16th century, I think all of the reformers, even if they end up disagreeing about, and they do, about what is permitted to be in the sanctuary, they are all dealing with this question of how do we prioritize the internal faith, the heart faith, that is then lived out in the life of the church, and that is rooted in the sufficiency of Jesus Christ and the sufficiency of what he has accomplished on the cross. And because of that, we can see that, you know, Luther, as a first wave reformer, has his own view that these are really objects and tools that have been abused, but that are essentially neutral. The material objects themselves are neutral. And, you know, you can really see how that tradition is going to move towards a memorialism. You know, it's basically stripping the statues of their power, their mediation, in order to replace that mediation with the true mediator, Jesus Christ, but not in a way that seeks to erase and remove the remembrance of those Christians who have come before. And of course, these statues are literally memorials then of remembrance. So that's one part of it. I think when we get into the Reformed tradition, that we are really seeing this care and concern over, you know, it really is about worship and right worship. And so the context of the sanctuary is what is essential there. And there is, it's hard for us to appreciate, but there is a sense, and especially for the populace of the Reformation in different places, because there were riots and there was iconoclasm even in Wittenberg, you know, in 1522, but that there is a sense that the leadership of the Roman Church has led people astray, led people to literally worship idols. And that is seen as a true betrayal and something that must be very seriously guarded against. And so, whereas I think, you know, today we're in a different context, you know, we may feel differently about these things. Maybe some of our traditions have gotten more lax. I mean, David and I are in the Reformed tradition in the Presbyterian Church, and I would say there is more openness to the arts and to iconography as a way to remember, and, you know, as a value without replacing Jesus. And so it's maybe a bit baffling, but you know, it was a change that I would say that needed to happen. It was a conversation that needed to happen. And it was one that does engage with John of Damascus.
Yeah.
It's also a great reminder of the fact that, you know, the reformers didn't always agree on everything. Like, there's a lot, of course, that sort of like collectively they are responding to, you know, their kind of understanding of late medieval Christianity. And as Jennifer was saying, the ways that it had led Christians astray. But there were a lot of things that they disagreed with among each other. And most notably, of course, is the delicate and difficult question of the presence of Christ in the celebration of the Lord's Supper. But this is another kind of practical issue. And so many things around the Reformation become kind of practical matters, right? Can you eat meat? You know, can you do this? Can you use icons or images in worship? And you have this interesting dynamic where someone like Luther is much more, you know, kind of in the sort of spirit of the freedom of a Christian. He's much more like, yeah, we can do this. He says at one point, if it's not a sin for me to have an image of Christ in my heart, why should it be a sin for me to have an image of him before my eyes? Mm. And so he and the tradition that follows after him is much more like, embracing of that. Whereas, as Jennifer was saying, the Reformed tradition is much more concerned, the particular way that Calvin and Zwingli and others read the Second Commandment, interpret that in terms of, you know, the context of worship, the concern that they have. Like, I think Exodus 32 is just kind of always in the back of their minds. Like, hey, this could always lead to a golden calf. Like, how do we avoid that?
Right.
That's kind of one of their ongoing issues and concerns. So it's a great, for them to be able to, learn from, okay, here's what John of Damascus said, during that time, how does that apply for us? It doesn't mean that we're always going to agree. You know, one of the great things that we found in writing this book together and writing Know the Theologians was that we found that, there are just some family members that we might disagree with, and that's okay. Like we can still,
we will definitely find.
You will. It's sort of like you go to the family reunion and you're like, oh, I know this person and that person. I've heard a story about that person and I have no idea who that person is. And our desire in a way through this book was sort of like, hey, get to know your family of faith.
Yeah.
Even if you don't totally agree with it, we still have a common faith. It's still a common, to use that, to kind of extend that metaphor, we're still gathered around this table together that we're celebrating as one family. So, your listeners, our readers today might not be familiar with John of Damascus. And so, even if you don't fully agree with his conclusions about, the ways that icons and images can serve the church in worship, still to appreciate, that these are brothers and sisters in Christ and actually can expand our understanding of the faith, all in the service of ultimately coming to know and love the triune God.
Mm. Now, you've written this book, Know the Theologians. We've been talking about John of Damascus. Jennifer, you're a theologian and historian yourself. And David, you have a special insight here because you are an acquisitions editor and have much experience looking at books and really understanding their value. So I really want to give you the last word here, both of you, because here is John of Damascus, and I always say to my students, listen, you haven't lived yet until you've read The Fount of Knowledge, or at least, you can find today, if you just go to a bookstore or Amazon, you can find a section of it, The Orthodox Faith. You haven't lived yet because this is one of the most significant works of theology. Listeners out there, they hear me say things like that. But for you, Jennifer and David, why is this book in particular worth their time? And out of the many books they're going to read in their life, why should this one be one they read and return to?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just jump in real quickly to say that I think it is an affirmation of what it means for God to come near. And we have to keep probing and thinking through that to be engaging with what that means at the heart of our faith, that God came near in Jesus Christ. And I think that's what he's emphasizing, and then of course relating to our relationship with Christ through right worship. That's the Christian life in my view.
Yeah, it brings up for me just the broader question of what it means to share this faith, of what it means to learn from the wisdom of others. One of the things, you mentioned my editorial role. One of the things that I so enjoy about that work is bringing the wisdom and words of fellow Christians to others to help us understand you know, our faith to help us understand, as Jennifer was saying, what it means that God came near in Christ, to understand the complexities and also the simplicity of our faith. Mm-hmm. And so whether it's John of Damascus or Irenaeus or other people that we point to in our own book, you know, it's all in an effort to help us understand and know and love God. So in my sort of day-to-day work as an editor, I love kind of, you know, encouraging people, bringing words to others so that we can shape the discourse and so they could understand their faith. So that, you know, our hope is that, you know, our book becomes just one other way that people can come to know and love and serve God more.
Now you can fill up on theology each day by visiting credomag.com. There you will find the latest issues of Credo Magazine with articles on key doctrines of the faith, and regular video interviews with Dr. Matthew Barrett, where he answers some of the toughest theological questions of our day. Be sure to subscribe to Credo Podcasts to join the conversation, a conversation where doctrine matters.